On the Radar, an Eagle News program that takes you beyond the streets and brings you closer to national and international breaking news as it unfolds. Tune in every Monday to Friday from 1 to 2:30.
Hello, good afternoon, Namibia. You tuned in to On the Radar this Wednesday, the 21st of May, 2025. And as always, we're coming to you live from the studios of Eagle FM. My name is Sean Jordan Uisip, and I'll be your host for today. As the week picks up pace, we've got stories that matter, the ones shaping our world today. From breaking developments in politics and business to tech, education, health, and grassroots impact, On the Radar keeps you in the know every step of the way. Thanks for making us a part of your day. Remember, you can follow us anytime, anywhere via the Eagle FM mobile app, our website, or your nearest FM frequency. Oh, and don't forget, real-time updates are just a click away on the Villager WhatsApp news channel. Now, let's dive into the stories making waves across Namibia today. The Namibian government, in partnership with the German development bank KfW and NamWater, has secured a 1.5 billion Namibian dollar concessional loan to fund the second phase of the Namibia Water Sector Supply Support Program. Signed in Windhoek, the agreement aims to strengthen the company's water infrastructure and resilience amid ongoing drought conditions and rising demand. The 20-year loan, which includes a 5-year grace period and favorable interest loans, will help expand access to clean water across central north and central eastern Namibia. At the heart of the program is the Omundangilo Omutsegwonime Bulk Pipeline Scheme, a large-scale project that includes 130 kilometers of new pipes, boreholes, reservoirs, and water treatment facilities. Once completed, it's expected to provide reliable water access to over 27,000 residents in the Ohangwena and Oshikoto regions, improving not only public health, but also the livelihoods and economic activity in rural areas. Officials say the investments reflect Namibia's commitment to innovative infrastructure financing and climate resilience. NamWater CEO called the loan a transformative step towards bridging the country's water access gap, while German Ambassador Thorsten Hütter praised the initiative as a model for sustainable, inclusive development. The project also includes the rollout of small-scale desalination plant units in remote areas, helping to secure long-term water security for vulnerable communities. My colleague, Happy Juju, reached out to the public relations officer, Lord Damonata, to discuss on this development and how NamWater intends to secure transparency on a major investment such as this one.
Good afternoon, Mr. Lord Damonata, and welcome to On the Radar News Bulletin.
Well, good afternoon, Madam Juju. Thank you so much for having an opportunity to us to discuss this matter, and thank you to your listeners.
Okay. Now, the Namibian government, in partnership with the German development bank KfW, has secured a 1.5 billion Namibian dollar concession loan to fund the second phase of the Namibia Water Sector Support Program. Kindly tell us more about this agreement and what it entails.
No, thank you very much for the opportunity. We do recognize that the media is a very good stakeholder and partner in this regard, and we thank the fact that Eagle FM was able to make this opportunity possible for us to engage. Well, you are correct that the Namibian government and NamWater, as well as the German development bank, known short as KfW, signed a $1.5 billion, that is 75 euros, concessional loan agreement yesterday on the 20th of May to fund the second phase of the Namibian Water Sector Support Program, that is known in short as WSSP2. Now, this investment represents a milestone in the sense that, it supports the country's effort to ensure that there is sustainable water future. Now, the funding will also be used to construct and rehabilitate that is essential bulk water infrastructure, particularly in the north and central north and eastern regions. As one of the driest countries in sub-Saharan Africa, Namibia continues to face growing pressure on its water resource. Mm-hmm. This is due to the persistent drought. You see that this year, for instance, it's for the very first time that we have had rains in abundance, and that our dams are looking well in terms of water security. And but before that, obviously, Namibia is subject to climate variability. And, you know, this investment, you know, it's a robust, it's about robust and resilient water infrastructure that we're trying to build that are needed to rise that, of course, the rising demand and protect livelihoods of people across the country. We know that water is a catalyst for development. So this water sector support program will ensure that we are reducing water losses. We expand access to clean water, as an example, and also strengthen sustainable water management practices. Obviously, as I indicated earlier, that, you know, the emphasis will also pay attention on rehabilitation and expansion of existing bulk water supply infrastructure, upgrade pipelines, reservoir systems, and introduction of small-scale desalination technology. So especially in rural areas. So indeed, it's attending to some of the infrastructure which is aging. And besides, this program is also connecting to other existing projects that are ongoing. For instance, another project that is separate from this is the financing of the Shakati Reclamation Plant, which will also be connected to this. So we ensure that there is a water integrated system. But however, in a nutshell, this is a big opportunity because it then addresses some of the shortcomings in terms of water infrastructure. And, you know, it presents an opportunity to ensure that we do our best to ensure that, as our motto says, that there should be, our brand promises, there should be water for all forever.
Okay. So what impact can residents alongside the Omundangilo Omtoon Wonime Bulk Pipeline Scheme expect once it's completed?
Well, thank you again. Under this flagship program financing that we finalized yesterday is that, you know, the Omundangilo Omtoon Wonime Pipeline Bike Line Scheme, for instance, you know, this is a transformative project in the sense that we'll see the construction of approximately 130 kilometers of new pipelines, production of, you know, boreholes, well fields, construction of reservoirs and booster stations, and treatment plants to treat this water. This project is expected to bring potable water to approximately 27,000 people within the Angwena and Oshkoto regions, greatly improving the quality of life. And we know that also public health will also be addressed. Economic activities in the area will also be boosted because people will have water, and water being a catalyst, means people can be able to address, to obviously set up even start their own businesses, for instance, you'll be able to construct your houses, you'll be able to ensure that schools have access to water. So definitely being a catalyst for change brings up some sort of, you know, a boom that is connected to other things. So we know that specifically also in addition to this, that something that is again different is that we have started with the construction already of the Ondangwa Oshali pipeline. This is the 17 kilometers from Ondangwa to Oshali. I can tell you when our executive team had a tour to the north sometime earlier this year, we saw that the 11.7 kilometers of the 17 kilometers were already completed. So which means, again, once this is done, this will all eventually be connected in one pipeline so that we ensure that, you know, we alleviate the water supply constraints, especially, again, when I said it will connect to Oshakati, to Ondangwa, Oshali, Omuthia, Omtoonime corridor, the phase one and phase two. So it is all part of the greater water integrated system that we're trying to connect. So definitively, but the major aspect is to say that the targeted people who are likely to benefit out of this in extension with other people who benefit is that the 27,000 people that are expected to benefit with access to water within the Oshkoto and Omsana region. So these are the major benefits of those that are likely to be impacted by this project.
And exactly how is NamWater preparing to handle the operational challenges that come with such large-scale upgrades, such as in areas with limited accessibility?
Well, to thank you again, in a nutshell, in addition to that question and prior to my prior answer, is the fact that by getting this financing, what we must be honest about and which we have always identified and we have not shied away is that investing in water infrastructure is a costly exercise. That we have always admitted. Yeah. And, you know, people will always say that, you know, perhaps when government is budgeting, why doesn't it not budget possibly, you know, in terms of its budget, the money to come? And yesterday, I'm glad that the Minister of Finance indicated to say this concessional loan agreement reflects Namibia's commitment of ways to fund critical infrastructure. You know, it's a fact that though it might not have come from a budget, for instance, it doesn't mean that these are the only tools that are at government's disposal to find alternative means of financing. Government went out, government found money and entered this project. So NamWater is prepared. NamWater wants to extend water services provisions. We know one of the challenges that we have is aging infrastructure, and the aging infrastructure comes with five best, you know, water leakages, water being unaccounted for from the point of production to the point of distribution. We want to reduce the water losses that we currently occur because it costs us money to produce this money, to ensure that, you know, we send this money from point A to point B.
Even so, to the residents themselves.
To the residents themselves. Water doesn't come for free. I know this thing conversation we have, we say, you know, we're trying to commercialize. And I want to put it on record and also indicate that we don't operate on a profit basis. We don't try to make money from the process. We operate on a cost recovery. So which means we try to manage our expenses in a sense that whatever it is that we put in is what we're able to recover. And the same sometimes when inhabitants say that, no, we are just profit driven. We are not profit driven. We are trying to ensure that we deliver water to everybody. And the good thing again, while government went out of the way to find this money for us to be able to carry out this project together with the Ministry of Agriculture, Water, Fisheries and Land Reform guiding us, is that we are committed to trying to ensure that everybody gets connected. And with the aging infrastructure which we have identified, and with this investment, this will boost our infrastructure and ensure that more people get access to potable drinking water. So, and we know if we can connect, for instance, a projected number of 27,000 people in Angoda and the Sokoto regions, we know the quality of life will improve, public health will improve, economic activities will improve, and we know eventually kids will start passing. We know that, you know, issues of diseases that might be affected because of a lack of water, for instance,
or lack of sanitation.
So, the lack of sanitation will also be addressed. So indeed, we are committed to this, and with this aging infrastructure also now being connected to the new infrastructure, it will give us an opportunity to upgrade our infrastructure so we can reduce water losses and also ensure that if when people who are connected to water services are also able to pay back, to pay for the water that they are receiving, it means it gives us an opportunity to be able to extend so that we can ensure that we cover 100% of the population of this country.
Absolutely. Now, with the concession loan being a major investment, what measures are in place to ensure transparency, timely delivery, and long-term sustainability of this project?
Well, thank you for the question. I think as we always do in our standard practice, even last year, once we have a contractor has been identified for this project, we will announce a signing ceremony, which will invite the media as our stakeholder to come and attend this event and report. So the procurement process in terms of this that will dictate to this project, as we have always done, is that it is open, it is transparent, it is advertised in the newspaper, it's advertised on other social media platforms so that people can be able to participate in this process. And once that is done, we'll also announce who has been selected. And once it has been selected, we will have a public signing ceremony so that the public is also aware to be informed what are the next stages. So it's very, very important that this is just the finalization of indicating that we have received, we have resourced, the government of Namibia sourced the money has been received. So other process will obviously also commence. Just as we were open about the fact that in terms of this agreement between the Namibian government, KfW, we talked about the fact that this concession alone and the Minister of Finance, and I'm going to cite her words, what she said yesterday, it is about government finding innovative ways to fund critical infrastructure. She indicated that these are favorable interest rate because it's at 10.09% below local market rates. And it's even lower by market rates by 2.3%. It is a 20-year repayment period with a 5-year grace period, which allows us to address urgent water challenges beyond the limits of the national budget. So which means the conditions are so favorable. There is nothing to hide. It's open there. It's a concessional loan. It means it'll have to be paid for back. The interests are clearly explained as what is expected. There's a grace period of 5 years before we start paying. The payment period is for 20 years. So we are clear and we are transparent about that. And we are committed to ensuring that even when we start, before we start with the project, one key aspect which is important to us is the issue of stakeholder engagement, especially within those specific regions, be it the inhabitants of those specific areas where they are affected, be it the two governors, especially from the two regions when it comes, for example, to the Omdongila, Mswanine, Oshkoto, and Hangwana regions, they will be engaged. The regional constituency councillors will engage, and the various inhabitants within those regions will be engaged to ensure that there is an understanding and that they understand what is being done at hand. And obviously, in terms of environmental compliance, all those studies that are required to take place will be done to ensure that we are fully compliant And we will keep the nation to date to inform us of what is happening. And when the contractor is on site before they start, there will be a site handover.
Mm.
There is going to be a groundbreaking ceremony so that we also inform what is the impact of this project likely to be, what is the expected time frame of completion of this project, and the contractor will also be introduced to the people that are on the ground and the leadership of the different regions so that they also understand that they have a relationship with those people, because the project eventually must make sense to the inhabitants of those two regions. And if you don't engage them, there's ability for them to be able not to associate well with the project, and that might bring us problems.
Indeed. Now, with all this being put in place, we look forward to actually following this project and keeping the listeners also informed with what's happening on ground. Thank you so much, Mr. Lot Ndamanumata, for making time for us right here on the radar.
Thank you so much for making time to speak to us, and thank you very much also to your listeners for making time to listen to us.
Okay.
Speaking at the ceremony, Minister of Agriculture, Fisheries, Water and Land Reform, Inge Zamwani, acknowledged that Namibia is currently faced with water scarcity and the dry climate due to unpredictable low rainfall that poses significant challenges to water delivery, and that the situation is further aggravated by the recurrent drought conditions in the country, which threatens the water scarcity supply in Namibia. She said the government has since declared water scarcity a national emergency and is giving high priority to water sector. It has also been identified that the water infrastructure of the country has for a long time now been plagued by underinvestment in the sector, and most of the water infrastructure has aged and are beyond their usable lifespan. Hence, in addressing the above-mentioned challenges will only be successfully achieved with the assistance of the development partners, she said. Thus far, funding for the upgrading for the direct portable reclamation plant, DPR2, and the upgrades to the Gamams and Ochomise wastewater treatment plants, the Oshakati purification plant extension, Rundu purification plant replacement, in Oyangwena 2 well field has been secured, and those projects' implementation are progressing well. However, the complexion of this project will require pipeline improvement and extension to distribute water to the community. The minister hence highlighted that this event, being the signing of the loan agreement valued at 75 million euros, which is approximately 1.5 billion Namibian dollar, stands as a statement to the enduring partnership between the two nations. And I quote, "This concession loan extended to the Republic of Namibia and the guarantee and guaranteed by the government of the Federal Republic of Germany through KfW, the German Development Bank, is a tangible outcome of our ongoing collaboration and will be disbursed in local currency. The loan terms and condition consist of, amongst others, a 10.09% interest rate and 20 years repayment period, including a grace period of 5 years. This interest rate is 2.3% lower than the local interest rate of similar maturity and provides sufficient grace period to allow the construction of this project before repayment." She further said that the funding is earmarked for the construction, rehabilitation and upgrading of extensive bulk water infrastructure, an investment of strategic importance that will directly address the long-standing water supply challenges faced by communities, particularly in the northern regions of the country. Now, she underscored that during the 2025-2026 budget presentation, the loan agreement, this particular loan agreement, falls under the category of project finance outside budget and will be implemented over the medium-term expenditure framework period. The projects to be executed by NamWater under the Water Sector Support Program are as follows. The Omdaungilo Omtewonime Bulk Pipeline Scheme, Phase 1 and Phase 2, which is a greenfield initiative involving the drilling of production boreholes, development of well fields, and construction of approximately 130 kilometers of new water pipeline. Secondly, the Oshakati, Ondangwa, Oshali, Omuthia, Onsewonime pipeline replacement, phase 1 and 2, with rising water demands and in anticipation of the Oshakati purification plant upgrade, which sources water from Klaus Angola, 150 kilometers away. Now, this project addresses infrastructure bottlenecks. Phase 1, Ondangwa to Oshali, began in 2023, self-financed by NamWater. Phase 2 will modernize remaining components of the Southeast Water Supply Scheme to serve Omusati, Oshana, Oangwena, and Oshikoto regions over a 15-year horizon. Katima Molilo Extension Phase 2. This project entails the upgrading and extension of NamWater's bulk water infrastructure in the Zambezi region, enabling integration with downstream water schemes currently being implemented by the Ministry of Agriculture, Water and Land Reform. It builds upon earlier interventions under the Water Sector Support Program 1, which was supported by an AFDB loan, and also the package plants, desalination units, small-scale desalination plants will be deployed on existing ministerial boreholes and shallow hand-dug wells. Now, this installation aimed to rapidly improve access to the potable water by enhancing the quality of saline groundwater across affected communities.
Are you thinking of stepping away? Don't. We're just getting started, and we have yet a lot more coming your way. So stay right with us, only on Eagle FM.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Listen to Eagle FM in Ludritz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager. Wherever you are.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
Welcome back. The latest edition of The Villager is now out, offering in-depth coverage of key issues shaping Namibia today. This edition has several pressing topics, including 60 out of 121 constituency youth enterprise proposals ready for financing. Rundu Town Council proposes 284 million Namibian dollar budget for 2025 and 2026. Import data highlights potential market potential for local plant production in Namibia. Namibia and China reaffirm relationship. COSDEC signs Memorandum of Understanding with the SOS Children's Village. Valvitra University and COSDEF signed Strategic Memorandum of Understanding to enhance education, research, and community engagement. Stay informed on social and economic developments by grabbing your copy of the e-paper. For real-time updates, subscribe to the Eagle Media House WhatsApp channel today.
Now, in other news, on the 20th of May, the UN Population Fund launched the UNFPA Youth Advisory Panel that focused on providing the youth with education and training to understand governance and contribute meaningfully to policy making, held at the UN House in Windhoek. Now, my colleague Sean Jordan Wisa attended the induction program, so let's engage him up on it. Yes, Sean. So
hello.
Can you tell us about the UN Youth Advisory Panel that's taking place at the UN House?
Yes. So in 2024, towards the end of 2024, the United Nations Population Fund set out a directive to put together a team of young people from across the country, from different regions, in an effort to engage with them and create a youth panel that engages in policy making, governance and leadership change, and a more well-rounded look at youth involvement in critical political and economical situations.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, that's interesting. Was there like a large number of turnouts of youth, and what was their feel? What were they saying? Are they excited about this? What are their contributions that were being done there?
So, of course, because this is a panel, they were all selected individually through an application. They had to send an application to the UNFPA, and then they were selected according to the amount of work that they've done with other organizations and how much they've shown up in policymaking already. Mm-hmm. So it's a real who's who of the youth. Mm. So in this session, they were all really excited to join. You could tell they were contributing meaningfully to the discussions. They were asking as many questions as possible, specifically with regards to data collection and how data shows up in policymaking and how data really affirms the different stances that different policymakers and legislative bodies have in the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So how many youth are they probably thinking of getting on board?
Apparently, quite a number of people applied for the position. About a few hundred applied for the actual position.
Okay.
There were about 30 people chosen out of those applications. Mm-hmm. And yeah, the application process was quite rigorous. They had they also had to do an interview at some point.
Yeah.
It was quite rigorous, but those that were successful are now reaping the benefits of that by being a part of this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What do you think this says about Namibian politics at large, having to involve youth into it and having, you know, with the challenges that we do face, you know, I take it that youth coming in, they understand the core challenges that if they make the decision it's going to be for them, you get?
Yeah.
Because those who are in power now, of course, they are aging, and the decisions that they're actually making is going to be for the youth. So now with the youth being involved, how do you think this is going to change Namibia's political landscape?
It is quite clear that having young voices in policymaking is quite important, as you've already mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
The people who are most at risk of experiencing the effects of policies 20, 30 years down the line are the youth. So it is important to get their not only opinion, but their input in it. So it is quite important because it also shows that there are different perspectives within the country. And young people, especially young people, have a different lived experience to that of people from the older generation.
Mm-hmm.
So putting those experiences together, especially with the fact that 50% of our population are young people.
Yeah.
So even right now in this day and age, it shows that youth participation is important because without them, you're leaving out 50% of the population.
Yeah.
And that's, that does not bode well for service delivery, especially with governance.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Now, I take it you did interview some people right there at this program.
Yes, yeah. I did, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Tell us what you were doing here today.
Okay, good day everyone. My name is Rivaldo Karun Kavanga. I am a law student at the University of Namibia, #BeFreeRing on Economic Foundation ambassador, and I'm here at the UNFPA Youth Advisory Panel induction workshop. So we applied for the Youth Advisory Panel for UNFPA, and we were selected last year. So we are just here for induction so that we can sign our code of conduct and officially become members of the UNFPA Youth Advisory Panel.
What is the Youth Advisory Panel, and can you give us a brief introduction of what you guys do or what you guys plan to do?
So the UNFPA Youth Advisory Panel will basically just be there to ensure that the programs of UNFPA speak towards young people. So what we will be doing is we'll just look at all the interventions that UNFPA have, ensure that they are meaningful and that they actually do benefit the young people at the end of the day, because one of UNFPA's core missions is to ensure that each young person is able to fulfill his or her potential. That's why we're here today. And basically the whole induction workshop is just for us to become accustomed with our roles, our responsibilities, and get an overview of UNFPA to properly understand what they do, what their programs are, what their mandate is, and how they will be implementing this, and also how we can inform their programs and initiatives.
Okay. What are some of the highlights from the day? What were some of your favorite parts of learning?
I think my highlight of the day is just learning. I think being in the space is, I think, 2016 when I became a hashtag PFRE ambassador. You sometimes get to think that you know it all. But then you come and you engage platforms like UNFPA, you meet the people that actually do the work behind the scenes, and you realize that you don't know it all. There were a few things that stood out to me, especially the double barrier that people with disabilities face, especially women with disabilities. So already as a woman, you're already discriminated against, and now you're also disabled towards the end of it. So it's a double barrier that you're facing. Also just the services that people with disabilities are enabled to access. It's really a learning curve, and you're also getting to see how you can align our mandate towards ensuring that people with disabilities are included in the space and that they could do get their services that they should get.
All right. Is there anything you're looking forward to the next 2 days that you can think of?
Yes, I saw on the program there's an overview or presentation that will be done on the SDGs. I really look forward to that because it's one of the key international agreements or international commitments that I am interested in. It covers everything, basically. So I want to see how we are going to localize it within the UNFPA Namibia's framework and how we're going to commit as a youth advisory panel towards achieving these SDGs. Also, more probably that I anticipate we can get is we can just see if we will be able to lobby for updated data, because I think one thing that also stood out for me today is that we still use 2013's data to inform some of the initiatives of UNDP, or we use what you call this projectiles that the United Nations does, which is not a accurate form of data to use. So we need up-to-date data to just ensure that the initiative and programs really speak to young people across board.
Okay, economically speaking, in your opinion, how do you think the outdated data affects Namibians today?
Economically speaking, it disadvantages Namibians a lot because, and especially in the framework of UNFPA, which mainly deals with sexual and reproductive health rights, we are unable to predict how many teenage mothers there are, how many babies there are that were born that need help. In regard to sexual reproductive health and rights. And as such, there's always a padlock. We are unable to determine how many young people we're supposed to provide services to ensure that they prevent, before even becoming pregnant, that we prevent unintended pregnancies in the country. So we know the consequences of unintended pregnancies on the economic framework or economic aspect of a person's life. So yes, it's outdated data disproportionately and negatively affects us.
Early in the presentation, one of the ladies mentioned the outcomes, the different outcomes that UNFPA does. So do you have a favorite outcome, one that you're looking forward to implementing in your own work?
I think the outcome that we should really work towards eliminating is towards gender-based violence and other harmful practices. Other harmful practices includes the rape of children, the molestation of children, which has been consistent in Namibia over the past few years. And I'm not speaking in regards to the recent occurrences in Okanja, but if you just follow the news consistently, you'd realize that this has been happening for over the past 3 years. So I really want us to end all forms of violence against women and children, and just to ensure that there's an end to violence across board, whether it's a man being a victim or survivor, that men being a survivor, woman being a survivor, or children being a survivor, violence should just be ended across board. So that's one of UNFPA's key outputs or outcomes that we are looking to achieve. And in my own line of work, what I really want to do is, we saw statistics today, albeit being outdated statistics, that about 30% of women felt that violence was justified by their male partners. Also have to what you call this, realign and ensure that these negative stereotypes are rid of, because it's very dangerous. And we also got to see the economic effects that gender-based violence causes on the economy, which is devastating and something I also never thought of. For instance, if a CEO commits gender-based violence against his wife, who is also a managing director at the company, you get to lose precious human resources that disproportionately affects the economy. So yes, it's very imperative that we end gender-based violence and understand what the effects of gender-based violence are socially, economically, and psychologically.
Okay. Hey, thank you.
Thank you so much, man.
Great interview.
Hi, my name is Pritesh Yisneunda. I'm from the Commerce region, and I've been selected to be part of the UNFPA Youth Advisory Panel. And today served as the induction, basically, where we got to meet all the other members. And being the first youth advisory panel in the country, it is then now an opportunity to pick each other's brains, brainstorm a bit, learn from each other's experiences, and then hopefully use that knowledge to develop our respective regions.
Okay, cool. Tell us a bit about what the YAP is, why are you here, what is it about?
Okay, so the Youth Advisory Panel basically selects young people from every region, and these young people will basically serve as representatives of that region's youth with regards to matters relating to sexual health and reproductive rights, mainly around that, but yeah, sexual health and reproductive rights is the main focus, although there are other SDGs as well that we will challenge and how they affect that, the main thing. But, overall, yes, our focus is on sexual health and reproductive rights.
Joshua Amukwaya, a national UN volunteer with the UN Population Fund, UNFPA, in Namibia, has spoken at conferences focused on empowering persons with disabilities, including youth with disabilities. During the first ever induction of the Youth Advisory Panel, Joshua has urged the Youth Advisory Panel and the government to advocate for disability inclusion. Amukwaya stated that this conversation has principles such as full participation so that disabled persons are able to speak for themselves. He emphasizes the importance of inclusive education, accessible data systems, and empowering youth with disabilities to participate fully in society. He further urges the panel to advocate for equality and that no one is made to feel half human. Hence, Joshua's work supporting the Namibian Organization of Youth with Disability and strengthening national planning for disability inclusion, which demonstrates how breaking barriers leads to real change. His journey shows that with the right support, persons with disabilities can thrive and lead transformational efforts for equity. Have you downloaded the Eagle FM app yet? Stay tuned to your favorite shows and podcasts, all at your fingertips. Search for Eagle FM Namibia on the App Store or Google Play and never miss a moment. But for now, we take a trip to the marketplace. Stay tuned.
Get social with us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our handle is Eagle FM Namibia.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than the Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
The Ministry of Health is currently developing a rehabilitative and assistive technology strategy for the country that will address the rehabilitative needs of the general population in terms of people living with disabilities, those that were impacted through accidents, and the assistance for people living with mental illnesses that they may require. Penda Ipindi, Executive Director of the Ministry, noted that these particular stakeholder inputs will contribute to the establishment of the strategy and its main aims of adding more improved services to people living with disabilities within communities.
Create this workshop that is dedicated to the formulation of the National Rehabilitation and Assistive Technology Strategic Planning. From the remarks, elaborate welcome remarks by the Director of Proceedings, from the remarks of Dr. Nadiamba, representing Dr. Banda, obviously we know very well that rehabilitation and assistive technology services are not just essential components of the healthcare system, they are transformative forces that significantly enhance people's health, that significantly enhance people's capabilities, people's productivity in the stream of the economy, and they are transformative forces that enhance the quality of life of people's concerns. By addressing the profound impact of the health conditions on individuals, these services focus on improving everyday functioning and reducing disability. They focus on enhancing inclusion and participation in economic activity and social life, and therefore they enhance the productivity of individuals in participating in these spheres of everyday activities. Through education and empowerment, rehabilitation enables people to manage their health conditions much, much better, to adapt to life situations and economic situations, and to remain active members of the society and the economy, thus fostering productivity, fostering economic growth, fostering improvement of living conditions of people.
Let's now pause for a scheduled ad break.
Okundana ombana wa kani hauto. Owapumba oshimaliwa mendelelo. Ndele ouna oshenditho. Ouna aniilonga yapumbwa okufutwa. Ashike mboka yina oondjodoe otayende kashona. Ngele onkalamwenyo otayi nyengana, otukesh otayi ningi ompu. Tu etena ohauto yoye eto pewa epasenda 45 dongushu yoshienditho shoye. Muule ashike womutetelo 45. Ino pumbwa oka payslip nenge ostatement ayombaanga. Ohauto yoye ashike. Mona omula oshimaliwa ethimbo weshipumbwa.
Easy money.
Tu dengela nena ko 061 600 ano ko 061 600 oshipulera ko autocash.
And now continuing on with the story.
Individuals and households and the fostering resilience. As we know, and it's said by the Director of Proceedings, Namibia, through the Ministry of Health and Social Services, had adopted the policy of universal health coverage, with the expressed national objective of providing affordable, accessible, and reliable healthcare services to all Namibians wherever they are. However, realizing such objectives.
Adding on to this, Ifindi pointed out that the plan or strategy would be ineffective if the accessibility of services associated to rehabilitation and assistive technologies is problematic and can and will lead to an imbalance.
It's unattainable if the provision of rehabilitation and assistive technology services is not broadly provided to reach out to everybody, so that no one is left out, no one is left out. And that provision should be strengthened at all levels of healthcare system. Notably, Director of Proceedings, these services are indispensable across all ages and phases of care, from acute to long-term care, supporting those with permanent and short-term inabilities and impairments, including as what we see represented in this room, including mobility, including vision, including hearing, including communication, and the cognitive challenges. As we actually gather here, there is a coinciding workshop that is taking place on the other side of town on wellness, and also looking at all aspects of wellness, including mental health issues and the causative factors that drive that phenomenon. And the figures are not also equally impressive, meaning that indeed the integrated approach to these phenomena and to enable individuals to be brought to back and to be enabled to participate in the mainstream economy and social life becomes quite important. Ladies and gentlemen, current evidence underscores the imperative for and the agency for actively providing rehabilitation and assistive technology services as an integral part of the healthcare system. As per the WHO reports and actually articulated here, globally an estimated population of about 2.5 billion people are currently living with a health condition that may.
Are you thinking of stepping away? Well, I hope you don't, because we'll be right back after these commercial messages.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
It's a scandal. Why do you give a tender to somebody who you know does not have capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person who doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura. And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we have been there before. We've had 6% growth before. Mm. It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past. Mm. And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Evil at them. The eye.
Ongo mnangeshifa ni wahara kushivika oma akuro ya kupitira mohorike radio station aweyo Eagle FM. Enya mkuro olongaha. Ningi kwa tafanu na Monica kushikondosha ipindi konorahita tuimwe, heari imwe, ne heari, imwe imwe no hamano. That is 0817147116. Mumberewa konorahita tu natu, mbali o hetatu vatatu. Ne nola no natu. Ninge tumo emaila ku monica@eaglefm.com.na. Opo mwane oshijemo shiri nawa.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Welcome back, and now we take you through what making headlines today on economic indicators. Non-agricultural commodities, the top commodity losers are orange juice at -0.87%, rubber at -0.58%, and cotton at -0.55%. Metal commodities, the top commodity losers are platinum at -0.83%. Gains are led by gold at 0.57%. On energy commodities, the top commodity gainers are crude oil, WTI, at 1.46%, Blend crude oil at 1.34%, and natural gas EU Dutch at 0.83%. South Africa retail sales at slower pace, rise at a slower pace. Now South Africa's retail trade growth slowed sharply to 1.5% year on year in March 2025. That is down from an upwardly revised 4.1% in February. This marked the smallest sales increase since September 2024, weighed down by a slowdown across several sectors, while general dealers are coming in at 0.3% versus 3.6% in February. Textiles, clothing, footwear, and leather goods at 3.5% versus 16.1%. Household furniture, appliances, and equipment are at 4.9% versus 5.9%, and all other retailers are at 1.1% versus 3.7%. Meanwhile, sales of food, beverages, and tobacco in specialized stores declined from a second consecutive month, falling at 2.6% after a 3.2% drop. In contrast, retail trade rebounded in pharmaceuticals and medical goods, cosmetics and toiletries, which grew 7.1% following a 0.2% decline in hardware, paint and glass, which rose 2.5% after a 3.8% concentration. Now, on a seasonally adjusted monthly basis, retail sales edged down 0.2% in March, following a revised 1.2% decline in February. Slovenia's unemployment rate fell to 4.6% in March 2025, that is from 4.9% in the previous month, now marking the lowest reading since November 2024. The number of unemployed persons declined by 2,427 month-on-month to 45,851. In March 2024, the unemployment rate stood at 4.7%. And that's what we had for you today on What's Trading in Economics. For now, we pause here, and when we return, we'll be bringing you news beyond the borders. So stay tuned.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of failure.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have the capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that doesn't have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past, and it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Did you know that in Namibia, over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077.
No matter where you are, if you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on the Apple App Store. Download the Eagle FM app to tune into live Eagle FM programming or to listen to podcasts of previous broadcasts. Eagle FM, Namibia's number one talk radio station.
On mineral exploration, a new bill has been gazetted in South Africa, which is urged to bolster surveys.
A new bill in the pipeline, as the country aims to give clarity on the critical mineral strategy following the controversial 2022 Mineral and Petroleum Resources Development Act. Critical minerals like platinum, manganese, chrome ore, and coal are set to come under the spotlight for exploration.
Our target is to attract 5% of total exploration budget. We're sitting as less than 1%, about 0.82%. That figure has been declining for the past 20 years, and it is important for us to improve on that.
This department is also doing research on the post-apartheid development of the sector to assess whether the previously disadvantaged are benefiting.
We'll have to do into the future is to commission a research on black capital
this
formation
is the first batch of
independence. Because in South Africa, contribution of the state to capital formations is always categorized as crime and corruption. But the reality of the matter is that any country that moves and gets liberated, the state has a responsibility to support and develop capital formations post-independence. And in South Africa, we have not done that very well.
Mining will also be looked into.
And if you look into that Stilfontein, when there were 1,500 plus people from Stilfontein, only 21 were from South Africa. The rest were from the region. And that confirms that it's an illegal activity that is actually dominated by neighboring countries. And we see it as an attack on the economy. And we don't think it's an accident, we think it's deliberate. But the investigation by the security cluster must trace the actual brains and people who drive it from the back.
And also, a word of caution to his cabinet colleague, Sports, Arts and Culture Minister, Gayton McKenzie.
Minister McKenzie yesterday, standing somewhere and saying the country is naked and so forth. I thought that was an overreach on his part, because there is a department with a Minister of Home Affairs to take a Minister of Sports, Arts and Culture to do monitoring in the border. It's actually an overreach, and it may only be used for political gains. It has nothing to do with the safety or less safety of the country.
With the decline in gold exploration, the department says the platinum group metals will remain an alternative. Ulelani Philip, SABC News, Parliament.
Free State municipalities on the brink of collapse.
Some municipalities are failing to honor their debt to Eskom and water board entity Vaal Central Water. Machabeng Municipality owes Vaal Central Water 6 billion rand. The municipality says the solution to this is to introduce prepaid water and electricity. It is also owed millions of rands by government for rates. As part of intervention, the municipality is conducting Operation Badala. It is also busy with fixing infrastructure of water and sanitation, which has also costed them millions of rands. Many pump stations are being refurbished while others are close to completion.
We have been embarking on an aggressive program of action, going around in Bizos, talking to our people. We have just now put demand, letters of demand to all the people that are owing us. And we will be embarking on summons. We are going to take legal action against them. We are owed by the provisional government more than 200 million. On water and electricity. We've just taken a decision this morning putting a letter of demand to the provisional government.
Cooperative governance wants the municipality to be placed under administration as part of their intervention.
We need prepaid. We need that support, prepaid. Intervention is not going to bring us money, because we don't have challenges on governance. We have challenges on financial recovery plan. We have challenges to get that support from the National Treasure, which is there was a commitment from the minister when he visited us that he was going to support us to be able to pay Eskom current account, to pay the Vaal Central current account.
There are a number of municipalities in the province where 139 was instituted for the longest of the time, and it has not yielded any material results to that effect as it pertains to finances, service delivery, including the ability to manage the debt of the municipality. So we believe strongly that that request was disingenuous.
In Nala municipality, the workers have downed tools for 2 weeks. They are against the administrator who is deployed. They also want their salaries paid.
The reason we are here is because we asked for intervention from COGTA, and the MEC was here 2 weeks back. Then he brought Mr. Goliath to come and intervene as an administrator. But Mr. Goliath, instead of coming to intervene, he already came here choosing the site. So what is happening now, Mr. Goliath is busy with the IDP things.
Meanwhile, the Muhukare municipality has been without a mayor since the axing of Zingi Samgauli. Workers have also downed tools for 3 months. A new mayor and speaker are expected to be elected by the council. Aphumelele Mdlalane, SABC News, Welkom.
Zambia Railways Limited has projected to generate about $30 million this year.
Very close to the rail line. This is just an example of the level of encroachment on Zambia Railways infrastructure. And that is not the only problem. Vandalism is also rampant. The Parliamentary Committee on Transport, Works and Supply was in Kitwe and Chambishi to appreciate the challenges facing Zambia Railways Limited.
The country is looking at increasing production of copper from the 800,000 metric tons to 3 million metric tons per annum. And now we can only move that copper after production if we have the necessary on the required infrastructure in place. And Zambia Railways is one of the major players that is going to play a very, very important role on that aspect.
Zambia Railways to be revamped. It's important when we are talking of growing the economy that we don't just look at the road infrastructure, but also the rail infrastructure.
Despite the challenges, management is focused on turning around the company.
But there is tremendous opportunity. Where we are now, this is an example of how private sector can work with government. This year, we're projecting about $30 million. Let me use US dollars, that's the language our friends understand. About 70% of that is coal. But for us, the potential, and when I say potential, I'm talking about orders on the table. We can do up to $85 million.
The committee also visited Sunline, its strategic partner of Zambia Railways Limited.
There's Zambia Railways in this partnership, so to speak, only two fronts. One, using the rail wagons to transport our goods here. And secondly, also we are renting their place here, this land where we are.
The parliamentarians want to see the company recapitalized and stiffer penalties against vandals and encroachers.
We've just been told that there is a lot of vandalism in terms of fish plates and some of these things that people are taking the scrap dealers, which is very, very unfortunate.
Such as encroachment and, of course, the dilapidated railway infrastructure that is on the ground. We have come to see for ourselves so that we can do a report, and this report can be directed to the executive to recapitalize Zambia Railways.
70% of the cargo transported by rail is coal, and Zambia Railways is positioning itself for much more. Chansa Mayani, ZMBC News, in Kitwe.
To boost local capacity in Uganda's oil and gas sector, the Uganda Petroleum Institute is set to train 140 youths for the oil and gas sector.
With first oil expected in the third quarter of 2026, the developers are wrapping up efforts to prepare a skilled workforce in line with the national local content law. Mugisa Ronald is one of the trainees who says this opportunity is life-changing.
I'm going to do 6G, coated welding, that's pipe. So I'm so happy to have this opportunity. Let this training be of great things to me. If I work with them at the site, I'll be happy for that.
We see expanding our scope to create more and more job positions, job opportunity, and to transform more and more knowledge to local, including the local people.
The Uganda Petroleum Institute of Chigumba is also running a similar program under the Tilinga Academy, with over 200 trainees receiving mentorship and training in countries like France, Oman and Malaysia. Unlike these overseas placements, this training targets 13 key trades essential for the central processing facility.
The UPIC has been blessed to have four training programs that have been launched here today. That includes instrumentation, it includes welding, it also includes pipe fitting and rigging. Those were some of the programs that are here, and the outcome of the program is that the young people who graduate here will have to be given international certifications, that is OPITO, the American Welding Society, and ECTIB.
Of course, as an institution, would have been very happy to offer holistic training, but you'll see, you'll appreciate that what the equipment we have here may not be sufficient enough to offer advanced training. So going forward, we need to, as a country, we need to look into that additional training, that additional equipment that has made this IPO transition from Uganda to abroad.
The Petroleum Authority of Uganda reports that the sector has now entered its peak phase, where job creation is at its highest. As of today, the oil and gas sector employs 16,375 people. Rwanda Habwe, NTV Business.
Kenyan President William Ruto has launched the first batch of new housing units.
Now, Africa's fast-growing carbon credit market.
This is the first batch of completed units under Kenyan President William Ruto's flagship affordable housing program. These ones are just over 1,000. Under the project, a key pillar of the president's bottom-up economic transformation agenda, the president aims to address Kenya's housing shortage, create jobs, and stimulate the local economy.
Today we are opening homes, and it is my utmost pleasure, and as I've said, this is one of the most consequential days in my political career, that today I can hand over keys to citizens of our nation, people who would otherwise have never had a chance at life, that today they have keys not just to open doors, not just to open a house, but to open a home into dignity, into livelihoods that are different, and we are making a difference in the lives of the people of Kenya.
These homes are offered under rent-to-own model, with monthly payments ranging from $24 to $40 over a 30-year period. But the project has faced harsh criticism from inception due to its funding model that imposed additional taxes to formerly employed workers, essentially appealing to salaried workers.
Let us believe in our country. Let us believe in our capacity to change the destiny of our nation. Let us believe in ourselves that it is doable, that we can transform our nation, that we can change slums into estates, and we can change the destiny of millions of our citizens. Let us believe in Kenya. Let us be patriotic citizens, citizens who believe in their nation, who believe in the well-being of each and every citizen and every one of us.
This allotment benefits residents of Mukuru Kwanjenga, an informal settlement where people have for years lived without basic amenities. The government has such projects across the country in the initiative, expected to significantly transform housing in the country while boosting economic growth. Ian Kinyua, CGTN.
Lawmakers in Nigeria have proposed compulsory voting to tackle low turnout.
Law to make voting mandatory has come under intense scrutiny. With over 93 million registered voters, the country leads Africa in numbers, but not turnout. Just 27% showed up for the 2023 elections, the lowest since Nigeria's return to democracy in 1999. Now lawmakers want to change that, proposing jail time or 100,000 naira fine for anyone who doesn't vote, a move which critics describe as a constitutional breach.
This is very draconian, and that it is an assault on the constitution. It is an assault on the fundamental rights of every citizen of Nigeria who is above 18. This law doesn't make sense even to the common man on the streets, because in enforcement, it will not see the light of the day. If it's enforceable at all, the Nigerian government does not have the capacity to hold over 10 million people in these prisons. Talk more of enforcing them or making them pay 100,000 naira.
While the bill's sponsors say it will boost participation, many argue it misses the point. They blame voters' apathy on deep-rooted issues like insecurity, electoral fraud, and lack of trust. Civil rights groups have said that forcing people to vote won't fix the broken faith in the system. They could end up punishing the powerless. As the debate heats up, one question looms. Can trust in democracy be forced, or must it be earned? Kelechi Amekalam, CGTN Abuja, Nigeria.
Families returning to Khartoum face the deadly risk of unexploded ammunition.
3 years after conflict broke out in Sudan, 62-year-old Abdulaziz Ali returned to Khartoum's Amarat district, where he used to work as a school administrator. But nothing is as it used to be. Instead, a new threat lurks in the rubble of Sudan's capital. Abdulaziz found these unexploded shells under a pile of old cloth.
Every day, I find two containers filled with ammunition and RPG rockets and other explosives, all in here. And this is a school, a children's school. All of these things needs to be cleared.
Ammunition and missiles litter streets, homes, schools and shops across the city where thousands of families have returned to. Sudanese and UN clearance teams are trying to make things safe. Volunteer groups have also taken up some of the work.
For the voluntary return of the people and for them to go back, their houses need to be safe. So we have started this initiative with a number of youth volunteering with us.
Sudan's National Mine Action Center says more than 12,000 devices have been destroyed over the course of the conflict, with thousands more discovered since operations expanded into newly retaken territory. Despite this, demining teams have barely scratched the surface, particularly in areas outside Khartoum. They say they need more staff and funds, particularly since the U.S. aid cuts.
We made an estimate with the United Nations for the donors that around $90 million U.S. dollars is needed to demine this year.
Without the proper sweeps, residents are left to fend for themselves. 16-year-old Mozar lost his left arm and suffered severe wounds when a shell exploded while his family was clearing rubble in their home on Tuti Island.
While we were sitting, we heard an explosion. It was a 23mm anti-aircraft round. Since I am a soldier, I know these things. He was sitting on a chair and suddenly it exploded without warning.
At least 16 civilians have been reported killed and dozens more wounded in munitions explosions in Sudan in recent weeks. Wilkinson Abosu, GTN.
Somali women urged to...
2 days after aid began entering Gaza, the
Somali women urged to tap into the blue market sea-based industries.
In February 2023, the federal government of Somalia, with support from the United Nations, launched the Women in the Maritime Sector National Action Plan. The aim was to enhance and empower Somali women in the maritime sector by giving them more opportunities. Then on Sunday, as the world marked International Day for Women in Maritime,
Years to go until the government will begin to phase out the sale of new petrol and diesel cars in the UK. The car industry is adapting, and the majority of new models being put onto the market now have either fully electric or hybrid engines. But last year, they made up just 20% of all car sales. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, has been investigating why.
Just look at the scale of this. Car companies have brought... dozens of cars and there are miles of track here at Millbrook Proving Ground to put them through their paces.
The 2025 SMMT event here.
But something's missing, isn't it? Have a listen. No roaring engines.
Every wannabe Clarkson in British journalism is almost certainly here. But here's an interesting fact. The car industry has brought 154 models to this show. 103 of them are either fully electric or hybrid. So what's that? 2 out of every 3? It is a measure of just how invested the industry is in the electric future.
Mike Hawes is the head of the UK's Society of Motor Industry Manufacturers and Traders.
You look at the investment the industry has made over the last 10 years. It has all been in electrification. They're trying not to develop petrol and diesel because they see those coming to a natural end. So the market, the industry is moving towards zero emission vehicles. What we need to make sure is the market follows it.
So take a look at what's on offer. Have a look at this. There are some pretty tasty electric cars on sale here, but lots of us just aren't convinced. So last year, 20% of cars sold were electric vehicles. Quite a few more were hybrids, but that is still well below the 28% target the government set. So what is the problem?
There are still so many people out there who think that EVs don't go far enough, they're too expensive, they burst into flames, etc., etc. You know, all those questions are answered these days, but it's a big leap of faith. And the most important thing is to get bums on seats, make sure people can live with these things and they experience them. But it's difficult to persuade people, particularly in the current climate.
But of course, there is another issue, the price. Electric cars have tended to be more expensive than petrol and diesel, but prices are falling. Take a look at this little city run around. 16 grand it'll cost you, and it'll do about 165 miles on a charge. For a couple of grand more, probably talking more like 200 miles. So let's take it for a spin. Let's see what this thing can do.
Even if the ticket price is a bit higher than petrol or diesel, on average, an EV driver is reckoned to save hundreds of pounds a year in running costs. And the average range is now around 300 miles.
Gotta try a top of the range EV as well. I've got to say, though, I'm a bit nervous about this one.
The Helvetia University September intake for 2025, all programs are fully accredited by the NQA. Certificates in Health Sciences Foundation, Level 4, 1 year full-time all campuses. Certificate for Enrolled Nurse Midwife, Acupuncture, Level 6, 2 years full-time in Windhoek, Kurenkuru, Combat, Vavis Bay, Katimamulilo, and Otapi. Diploma in Environmental Health Sciences, Level 6, 2 years full-time in Windhoek. Bachelor of Nursing and Midwifery Science Honours, 4 years full-time in Windhoek, Kurenkuru, Combat, Vavis Bay, and Katimamulilo. Postgraduate Diplomas in Mental Health Nursing, Level 8, 1 year full-time in Windhoek. Postgraduate Diploma in Community Health Nursing, Level 8, 1 year full-time in Windhoek. The application period is from the 1st of May until the 30th of June 2025. For more information, contact 061-22-5463 or 061-22-5462. The Helvetia University, where everyone is an achiever.
This May, it's time to celebrate excellence, achievement, and the future. The International University of Namibia of Management will proudly host its 2025 Winter Convocation Ceremony, taking place over two exciting days, Thursday the 22nd and Friday the 23rd of May 2025 at the elegant Windhoek Country Club Resort. With two graduation sessions each day, we're honoring the hard work and dedication of our incredible graduates. Can't make it in person? No problem. Join us from anywhere. All four sessions will be live streamed on the IUM Facebook page. Thursday, the 22nd of May 2025 graduation ceremony will be live on Eagle FM from 8 a.m. Join us in celebrating the future of Namibia, because at IUM, We're advancing knowledge and training leaders. Save the dates and tune in.
Our America. His top diplomat, Marco Rubio, has been questioned by the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, his first appearance since becoming Secretary of State. During the hearing, Mr. Rubio discussed the possibility of Syria falling into civil war, the difficulty of reaching agreement with Iran over their nuclear program, and the threat from China, and also Ukraine and Russia. One senator suggested to Mr. Rubio that President Putin is, quote, playing Donald Trump like a fiddle. Here's the Secretary of State's response.
Because the truth of the matter is, when Vladimir Putin woke up this morning, he had the same set of sanctions on him that he's always had since the beginning of this conflict, and Ukraine was still getting armaments and shipments from us and from our allies, and the European Union is about to impose additional sanctions, and the U.S. is looking for no Patriot batteries to be able to transfer from other NATO nations into Ukrainian hands. And what the president's trying to do is end a war. He's trying to end a bloody, costly war that neither side can win, and people are dying every single day.
Let's speak to our State Department correspondent, Tom Bateman. So, Tom, on the subject of Ukraine, what do you think we learned there?
Well, it was a consistent theme among Democrat senators, and what you heard there was a response, Marco Rubio's response to Jeanne Shaheen, the leading Democrat on the committee. And what was put to him was the argument that, as you heard, Vladimir Putin had played President Trump like a fiddle. She wasn't the only senator to use that expression. His argument was very much about sanctions, that all of those sanctions that had existed under the Biden administration continued to be imposed on President Putin, that he was waking up every morning still with those constraints around him, and that that gave the U.S. leverage. But we heard really senator after senator among the Democrats really push back at that argument and suggest that because the administration had not meaningfully and publicly called for concessions from Moscow, that had effectively weakened the Americans' leverage in this entire process. And that went alongside quite a lot of accusations that the Ukrainians had sort of been hung out to dry on several occasions, particularly on the issue of weapons support. Remember that pause that the Americans imposed on weapons and intelligence sharing earlier in the year. Again, Mr. Rubio pushed back on that and suggested that they basically needed to have the leverage with both sides in order to get the outcome that President Trump wants, which is a ceasefire.
And just taking us back to the Middle East for a moment, Tom, also some interesting insight into U.S. communications with Israel.
Yeah, we got a confirmation basically from Marco Rubio that the Trump administration has been applying some pressure on its Israeli ally over the last few days to lift part of that aid blockade. Mr. Rubio saying that he was pleased that some aid had now finally been allowed in, but agreeing with the view that it was insufficient. So,
U.S. film studios welcome Trump's foreign film tariff proposal.
Local film studios Reuters spoke to in Atlanta were welcoming of Donald Trump's recent proposal of 100% tariffs on foreign-made movies. The U.S. president floated the idea on his Truth Social platform earlier this month. He claimed then that the U.S. movie industry was dying a very fast death due to financial perks foreign governments have been offering filmmakers. There is some truth to that, according to members of the film industry in Atlanta, Georgia last week, including Crystal Carroll, director of operations at West End Production Park.
Spider-Man, when they lease the building, Spider-Man uses elevator shaft and it is cool tricks and things like that.
Marvel's Avengers Endgame and Netflix's Ozark and Stranger Things all did some filming at West End, according to their website. Carol says she's seen production slip away firsthand as major studios film abroad to capitalize on incentives.
Canada, and I've lost some to Vancouver or Mexico. As we're waiting to get word back of where they're going to go, then I get the final word that, oh, Crystal, I'm sorry, they're going to go elsewhere, out of the country, because they're saving money. We're hoping that with the tariffs, it will just bring the productions back to Georgia and let us compete amongst each other, not internationally.
Elon Brooks, who owns a small studio also in Atlanta, says he sees long-term gains in Trump's tariff proposal.
Because right now, Malta is taking in so much of our production business, and other countries that are offering these kinds of deals because the labor's cheaper, the locations are cheaper, there's just a lot of incentives across the board.
But a forced move back to the U.S. would likely drive up production budgets. The industry now relies on a global supply chain with shoots in Europe, post-production hubs in Canada, and visual effects teams spread across Southeast Asia. It's also unclear how the tariffs would work. Trump's tariff post was short on details and didn't say if the levies target films in theaters or on streaming, or what gets taxed, production costs or box office numbers. The industry has seemed baffled by the idea, including director Wes Anderson at the Cannes Film Festival Tuesday.
Can you hold up the movie in customs? I feel it doesn't ship that way.
Meanwhile, experts have warned of unintended consequences. Kate Fortmuller, a Georgia State University associate professor of film, worries other countries may retaliate against U.S. movies.
Hollywood's a global industry. It's always been a global industry. It depends on global audiences. It depends on global labor. Historically, Hollywood has been known for taking directors from other countries in the 30s and the 40s, using, right, Germany had a great industry, so let's take some German stars and directors and have them work for Hollywood, right? So it has always been global, and it becomes very hard to disentangle that from its identity.
She says films shot overseas are an intangible product, a service, not physical goods. And so applying a traditional goods tariff on a service industry is also problematic.
Google said that it would put artificial intelligence in the hands of more web surfers while teasing a $249 a month subscription for its AI power users.
Google is doubling down on AI-powered search. The tech giant said Tuesday that its latest system would allow users to ask almost anything, from simple queries to the most complex research questions. Sundar Pichai, the boss of parent firm Alphabet, set out the new AI mode at the tech giant's annual conference in California.
Users have been asking much longer queries, 2 to 3 times the length of traditional searches. And you can go further with follow-up questions. All of this is available today as a new tab right in search.
The new search mode is powered by Google's Gemini AI model. Over time, its abilities will be integrated into the regular search box. Tuesday also saw the demonstration of other products, including smart glasses. They also feature AI integration and claim to offer simultaneous translation between languages. Google also launched a subscription option priced at just under $250 per month. It offers higher limits on AI usage and early access to experimental tools, including a browser extension dubbed Project Mariner.
It's an agent that can interact with the web and get stuff done. Stepping back, we think of agents as systems that combine the intelligence of advanced AI models with access to tools. They can take actions on your behalf and under your control.
All the activity comes as Google feels the pressure to stay ahead of rivals like OpenAI. The ChatGPT maker is among firms offering their own take on AI search, potentially threatening Google's core business.
Oil prices jump over fears Israel planning attack on Iran.
Oil prices jumped Wednesday over fears that Israel could be planning an attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. International benchmark Brent crude was up around 1.5% by mid-afternoon in Asia. That followed reports by CNN that Israel is planning an airstrike. It cited U.S. officials as a source. The report said Israel had been observed positioning munitions at airbases and conducting what could be a preparatory exercise. But CNN said it wasn't clear if Israel had made a final decision to strike. Traders fear any attack could threaten crude supplies from Iran, the third largest producer in the OPEC group of oil exporters. There are also concerns that Tehran could retaliate.
Shifting focus for now. Now, Russia claims to
calling for more to take place. But it came among a few really testy exchanges on Gaza. That was in an exchange with Jeff Merkley, a Democrat senator, who asked Mr. Rubio if the administration was making it clear to its Israeli ally that it was unacceptable, in his words, to use food as an instrument of war. And also, he asserted that the Israelis had been systematically destroying Palestinian homes as a means to drive out Palestinians. And we got another interesting confirmation from Mr. Rubio there that they have been speaking to other countries about what he called the temporary relocation of Palestinians. Now, this had followed a report, a US media report over the weekend, that the administration had been speaking to Libya about taking up to 1 million Palestinians. That had been denied by the White House. Mr. Rubio said he wasn't aware of that, but he did say, as I say, that they're talking to some other countries about the movement. All of this, of course, in light of President Trump's ideas to expel Palestinians from the Gaza Strip and for the US to annex it, a move that would be in breach of international law, although the administration has always tried to characterize this as some kind of humanitarian gesture. But Mr. Rubio therefore putting a bit more emphasis on those reports.
And that wraps up today's On the Radar News Bulletin. Stay tuned for Onkundana Ndingi with David Shombe, followed by the Home Run Show with Dwight and Helmut at 4:30. Don't forget, The Villager will be available on Wednesdays with more in-depth stories and analysis. As we kick off to the end of May, we wish you a wonderful end to the month. May bring fresh opportunities. Have a great week, and until next time, goodbye.
Listen to Eagle FM in Lüderitz at 91.2 FM. Listen to Eagle FM in Omthea at 90.5. Listen to Eagle FM in Mariental at 101.2. Listen to Eagle FM in Okahanja at 104. Eagle FM lets you express your constitutional rights of freedom of expression without fear of favor.
This is actually, to put it mildly, an economic scandal.
Fraud.
Not fraud, it's a scandal.
Scandal.
Why do you give a tender to somebody who does not have the capacity to build? Why should you do that? You know a person that does not have the capacity to build.
Eagle FM lets you talk.
That's why I'm always telling people in Parliament, let me not take up my Katatura menace.
Right.
Because I grew up in Katatura.
Uh-huh.
And I will not hesitate to tell you off if it is needed to
be part of the debate by setting the agenda.
My response in terms of Rwanda at 6% is that we had been there before. We've had 6% growth before.
Mm.
It's not something that Namibia has not achieved in the past.
Mm.
And it's not something that Namibia will not be able to achieve in the future.
Eagle FM, the eye.
Did you know that in Namibia, over 1.4 million people use their mobile device to access the internet? So why not meet your current and potential customers where they already are? With over 600,000 cumulative users around the world, between the Eagle FM and Imba mobile apps, Eagle Media House has the perfect digital platforms for you to advertise your business, upcoming events, weddings, vacancies, funerals, or any other announcement that you have on their digital billboards in their mobile applications. Put your ad on our digital billboards, and with one tap of the screen, lead users directly to an address of your choosing. For more information, contact Hende at 081-410-9077. That's 081-410-9077.
Want to know about Namibia's latest business and economic news? Then look no further than The Villager newspaper. The Villager is an e-paper that is published every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for free, directly to your phone or computer. To become a subscriber, simply send a WhatsApp message with your number and email address to 081-200-4144. Be sure to save the phone number as a contact. The Villager, wherever you are.
Ouli mnangeshefa nohara kushivika oma akuro yo kupitira muhorike radio station yo Eagle FM enyamukuru olongaha ningikwata fano na Monica kushikondosha ipindi konorahita timwe heali imwe ne heali imwe imwe nohamano. That is 0817147116 momberewa konorahita tunatu bali ohetatu vatatu ne nola no natu nenge tumo emaila ku monica@eaglefm.com.na opo umone oshijemo shiri nawa.
Eagle FM, the eye.
No matter where you are, If you have a mobile device, you can tune into Namibia's number one talk radio station by downloading the Eagle FM app on the Google Play Store or on